You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. On a Tuesday, we're going to get Grant Newsham on the phone here, so we got to do the Skype Kabuki dance here. And so momentarily, the man, the myth, the legend. Yeah. Love that Skype music.
Grant Newsham speaking.
Grant Newsham, Mike McNamara, welcome to All Marine Radio. How are you this fine Tuesday morning?
Yeah, I'm here. I can hear you.
Oh. Well, I've been messing with my computer trying to make it work because I've been listening to you fidget with something, waiting for me to patiently come on, and the settings weren't right.
So, okay, well, I hear you pretty good now.
All right, so I apologize. Welcome to All Marine Radio, and thank you for doing this. We're,
okay. We're, yeah, I've got a daughter with wears jeans with no knees as well. So
you heard that.
I know what you're talking about. I don't say anything.
She paid the price. You know what? And here's the story behind the jeans with no knees. Colleen and I on Friday are going to the rededication of the 1st Marine Division colors. It's a big deal. So I said, do you have clean clothes? Do we need to go by and get a dress? And she said, well, we could go by. I said, well, it might be cold, so do you have jeans? She said, yeah. I said, and they're clean. And she said, well, yeah, I'll wear my clean ones. So, and I'm, you know, I set the audio up for the program for 3 hours, make sure everything's right. Right. And then pack the stuff in the car, make sure the dogs are taken care of, get in the car. And we just get on the freeway, and I look, and I see her knees sticking out of her jeans. I'm like, what the hell is that? And she looks at me like, I've gone someplace I'm not supposed to go. And I said, Colleen, what the hell? She goes, well, they were my clean ones. I said, yeah, but they have holes in them, for God's sakes.
She's like, well, it's your fault.
You know what? It is, yeah. Right? 6-step in troop leading is supervised. And when you don't supervise, that's what you get. So the remedy was my wool toggle coat in the 77-degree heat. And so anyway, hopefully, and not that she'll care, but it'll be a good story at some point one day. But anyway, where are you these days? Are you in Hawaii? Are you someplace else?
No, I'm actually in Tokyo for a few days.
All right. Well, there's interesting things going on in the Pacific Rim. Before we talk about what you've written, in terms of current events, what's the most interesting thing going on in the region these days with the Olympics in the offing?
I think the Olympics has kind of created a lull of sorts. It
right.
looks like it, because North Korea is not going to do anything during the Olympics since they asked the South Koreans to be allowed to participate, sort of as part of the South Korean team. So they're going to be on decent behavior. But I think the significance here there is that the South Korean administration so willingly sort of bit the bait. And I think they genuinely, there are people in that administration who think that a deal can be cut with the North Koreans. And so this has the effect, actually, of causing the pressure that had been building up on the North Korean regime to sort of relax for a bit, at least for a period of weeks. So a lot of the momentum, I think, has been lost. It appears the South Koreans didn't really notify the Americans of what they intended to do with North Korea. And a lot of that's in the momentum, the pressure. It's really eased up a bit, I think, which is, in my perspective, is not a good thing. That hasn't got a whole lot of reporting, but I think if one considers what the administration was trying to do, create some sort of a more comprehensive, a more unified approach towards pressuring and North Korea, that this has lost some of the steam's gone out of it for a bit. You know, we'll see how this plays out, but we're going to have to wait till the end of this month, once the Olympics are over, to see what the Trump administration can do to get things moving again.
what kind of pressure is the government of Korea under not to be America and Donald Trump's bitch in all of this? And to go their own way, to be the lead in this negotiation with the other half of the peninsula. Is Washington our friend? Is Donald Trump somebody who's going to unwittingly drag us down the road to a confrontation in which we will pay the butcher bill and the United States won't, other than the small numbers of their members of the armed service that get killed in such conflict? What is the domestic South Korean view of the government's role? Are they the lead in this? Are they a step behind the United States? Are they in partners? Give us some sense of that, sir.
I think there's a genuine belief on the part of Moon, the head of South Korea, the president, and many of his advisors, the people around him, a genuine belief that they can cut a deal, that they're the ones who know how to work something out with North Korea, and that that's the problem. It's because North Korea has felt threatened, and it just takes some Koreans to talk to other Koreans, and they can figure it out. You might compare it, say, to the, in our experience, we had Jimmy Carter, who, when he came in, the belief was that Russia acted the way it did because it was afraid. It was felt threatened. And that proved to be wrong. But then you had come along to the Obama administration, and even in the Clinton administration to a degree, there was an idea that the problems were caused by the Americans being the threat. So you have this idea that appeasement, that negotiation, just understanding the other guy is all that's needed. And that's, I think the South Koreans have their version of that. They have always had a faction that has thought this, at least twice in the years since democracy came back. And this is just the third time or so that I can count that they've tried this nutty notion. And, I suppose it's always statistically possible it might work, but I think experience suggests that it will not. But at the same time, it's not as if they want to throw the Americans out, but there's maybe less of a connection or a commitment to the United States with this administration in Korea than other administrations have had, because you do have within South Korea a large part of the population, particularly older people, that are very well disposed towards the United States. In the sort of younger generations, that sort of psychic connection has diminished. But it's not to say we're going to split apart from each other just yet. But sometimes things, serious things, start with a small bit of friction, sort of a small piece of sand in the gears, and you eventually have things turn out in ways that people might not have expected, and even in ways that most people might not have wanted. I think the Philippines experience, when they kicked us out of, when a small group of Filipino leaders got together and kicked us out of Subic Bay and Clark Air Base, that has had a pretty serious lasting effect, and nobody really thought it was going to happen right up until it did.
You predicted just about everything that we've seen, quite rightly. You predicted that when it did begin to get uncomfortably tight, that there would be some sort of charm offensive. You also told us that there would be elements of in more so Korea than Japan I don't know, you didn't use the word desperately, but I want to say idealistically want to believe that they can solve the problem, which will fracture or set back the effort to tighten the sanctions, to tighten the pressure on North Korea to get them to modify their behavior. You also talked about, and it's been in the news over the course of the last week, the way North Korea gets around any type of sanctions that will go ahead and be levied against it by the United Nations, yada, 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 that they're fairly adept at this, especially at the things that they're the ruling class in North Korea is not going to do without. Give us an update on the sanctions, the people circumventing those sanctions and helping to circumvent those sanctions from both Russia and China. How is the whole sanction thing playing out?
It appears to be that the effort is continuing, and I get the impression that it's certainly behind the scenes. The U.S. is doing a fair amount, more than they've ever done, to pressure and expose the licit and illicit North Korean money-making activities.
Right.
And it appears that the Chinese are cooperating a little bit more, but I would consider that really marginal, not a sea change in Chinese behavior. I think, but the Chinese are feeling some pressure apparently from the U.S., but also from being exposed for the efforts they've made to facilitate North Korean activities with the Russians. Unfortunately, I don't think they care with that. And they have always been sort of a safety valve for the North Koreans. So even if the Chinese do marginally ratchet up the pressure, that the Russians have been pretty willing to do whatever's necessary to help the North Koreans. And there's always been a very substantial coastal trade with by ship between Russia and North Korea, and that goes back a long time before the North Korean, the latest round of pressure on North Korea became an issue. So I think it's to the administration's credit, I think they are trying, but it's not at the point where it is going to cause North Korea to really start sweating and modify their behavior, is my impression on that. So the jury's still out, and the administration is trying. But time will tell. It's really when North Korea starts to really scream bloody murder, then you'll know it's having an effect. But they haven't really shown the telltale signs just yet. That the efforts are having a lot of effect, or having the effect we want them to have. But do keep in mind that virtually nothing was done until starting maybe a year ago. That's not much of an exaggeration. Virtually nothing was done. So it's late in the day to get started. Be better if it had been done sooner, but it's still a little early to get to expect too many results, but we don't have all that much time either.
I chuckle now when I see news headlines, Grant, because of I think everybody who listens to the program has benefited from your education. 2 weeks ago, the Navy did some sort of Freedom of Navigation Act in the South China Sea and had the unmitigated gall to sail within 12 nautical miles of the fortified islands in the Scarborough Shoals, and China said that the United States was forcing it to further militarize the region with its provocative actions, and it's laughable. And then just in the sake of discussion, I reposted. What is it called? The 9-mile line, or what is that line that the Chinese have?
Well, it's the 9-dash line.
The 9-dash line.
Yeah, which basically says the South China Sea is theirs because a Chinese person laid eyes on it once.
So you look at it, and the 9-dash line goes. There's China, right? It goes down the Vietnamese coast, over to the Indonesian coast, and then up along the Filipino coast. And you're looking at this line and you're thinking, you've got to be kidding me. And the reason that comes to mind is you said until a year ago, nothing had been done to the North Koreans. We've taken that recipe for success in the South China Sea, which is doing nothing except hand-wringing and bloviating, and we're applying it to North Korea as well. Nothing. Nothing. And it is simply, I find it amazing where we are now, that the fact that a Freedom of Navigation Act in international waters that have been affirmed by the International Court of the Hague, who said that the Chinese have absolutely no claim to the Scarborough Shoals, which is on the doorstep of the Philippines, for God's sakes. And yet, China does what it does, and nobody pushes back. And so it's a pretty interesting little kabuki dance to watch. And we'll see now that the stakes are vastly higher in Korea, if pressure, you know, does have its effect. Email for you, Grant. Hey, Mac, what will we hear? Grant just said we will hear North Korea screaming. What will it look like when they begin to feel pressure? Because I assume that after the charade of the Olympics is over, we will get back about this. And so come summer sometime, North Korea will be screaming again. What will their screaming look like?
I think what I would watch out for is when they start begging for international assistance. That'll be food in particular. Then you'll know that they're having some trouble. They complain when they start publicly complaining and excoriating. It'll be the Americans for the harm, the damage they're doing to the North Korean people. That'll be a pretty good indicator of what. That we're having some effect. And you've seen this in the past, is when they do really get into trouble, they start demanding food, demanding help, and demanding aid. And in the past, they've always gotten it. You know, even the Americans, we will give so-called humanitarian aid, you know, food in particular. The claim is, well, you can't divorce humanitarian issues from, or you can divorce humanitarian issues from political ones. Unfortunately, with these kind of regimes, you cannot. So I think it's that those things in particular I would look out for.
Okay. So and to what purpose would that serve the humanitarian aid? Because it's not like they care about the citizenry. That will be simply a way to twist a knife into the United States to try to create some kind of space between the people that are implementing these sanctions. To what extent, or are they going to take those food imports and then sell them to somebody else in order to create the hard currency they need?
Well, it could be some of all of both of that. They certainly, with these kinds of regimes, they use the what comes in for themselves, or that ruling clique, the people who are associated with the ruling class, the people who need the food get almost none of it, if any. And I don't know if having a PhD from the Ivy League prevents one from recognizing that, but it's pretty obvious that, you know, the Kim regime and everyone that's ever existed like it, when it gets something, well, it will take care of its own needs first, and the people whose support it counts on. Often that includes the military as well. And it's the people at the bottom of the pecking order, which is usually about 90% of the population, who will not get much more than they've ever had. And everyone knows that the aid is diverted, and that because of that aid, the regime can use some other resources for things like developing nuclear weapons, and missiles and that sort of thing. But this is, you know, so we've just seen this over and over. And the best approach is when a regime like that is screaming is to double the pressure. Anything that you can do to make it even harder for them. And once again, the chattering class, or the worrisome class, is going to come, you know, cry about, well, we can't starve people and this and that, with the idea being it's our fault, and when in actual fact it's not. And it's just surprising how seldom anybody actually blames North Korea for the problems that we've got in Northeast Asia now.
Another email. Mac, I'm sorry to be the bonehead in the room. Could Grant bring us up to snuff on where he believes the North Koreans are relative to developing an intercontinental ballistic missile capable of bringing a nuclear warhead into the United States? And two, where they are in terms of development of that warhead. We all know it needs to be miniaturized, and it needs to be able to sustain reentry. Where are they relative to those two questions, the delivery mechanism and the actual warhead itself that could sit atop that and function? Good question. That's not a bonehead question, by the way. That's a good one.
That is a good question. Hey, you'd think that for our $60, $70 billion in the intelligence budget that we should have some idea of what the answer is. But the answer seems to always be about somewhere between a year or two away. And it's been like that for about the last 4 or 5 years.
Right.
There's different estimates, and one of these days somebody's going to get it right. But it does seem as though, and this is just my impression from all the stuff I read and a few people I talk to, that I think the ICBM capability, capable of hitting the United States and pretty much hitting what you wanted to hit, I think that, you know, once again, it's debatable, but, you know, I would imagine that, say you wait, say, 2 years from today, and I think we may find ourselves, if everything continues on this trend, I think we might find that the North Koreans have got a good bit of the U.S. in range and can get fairly close to what they want to hit. So I'd throw out a couple of years on the missile angle. In terms of hitting Tokyo, that's really easy right now. But the U.S. would be harder. But that's, once again, I'd throw out a couple of years.
And so when we say a couple of years, in terms of where are they relative to the warhead itself? Because that's, to me, the piece that they seem, or at least you hear the most dubious reporting, that, yeah, they can set these things off underground, which they've been doing for years. However, they can't miniaturize it yet. They can't get it on a re-enterable ICBM. Is there? Yeah. What's the best intelligence say about that?
Oh boy, I wouldn't know what the best intelligence is.
What about the worst intelligence? What is the worst intelligence?
That would probably be mine. They have though made progress apparently in miniaturizing nuclear weapons. And this is an engineering problem, and they eventually will get it down about, you know, they'll get it to where they need it to be. And do keep in mind, I think, that the Pakistanis have managed to figure this out, and the North Koreans will figure it out too. So they are making progress. People can debate how fast it is or what rate it's going. But certainly I would think that within a couple of years that we could have, if you think back where we were 2 years before today, that in a couple of years they could get things small enough, be able to fit them onto the missiles, get the reentry capability right, and then they just might have what they need at that point. It's always difficult to predict, but they've been working on it for a long time now, and they do. These are not stupid people, and they're working obviously with the Iranians. They've gotten help from other people as well. The Chinese have assisted. So I would, I think we will find that gradually over the next 2 years, there are additional tests, each of which indicates a degree of progress. And, you know, so I would just roughly throw out 2 years as a time to when we just might find them with a good missile and good nuclear capability. That you can put it on a missile, shoot it at the United States, and hit what you're aiming at. Now, that's what I would throw out. But once again, I'm not privy to the best intelligence, of course.
Right.
And nor am I a missile or a nuclear expert. But, you know, having watched how this has progressed, and also seeing how the Pakistanis went about it, and roughly how long it took them to get things right, and also the progress the Iranians have made, I think we're coming to a point where they're going to have what they need, but I don't think it'll be tomorrow, and I don't think it will be within a year. And I would just add on an extra year and Maybe then there'll be some real reason to worry about this. Well, to worry about it more.
Interesting. The proverbial 2 years continues to that clock continues not to move. The you wrote recently about Boeing and the Chinese government. First of all, could you give everybody the basis of the story, and then we'll talk about the thrust of the article. So the background of the story, Boeing in China, is what?
What I wrote is a story about Boeing's move into the Chinese market. The Boeing estimates that within, there's going to be a demand within over the next 10, 20 years for about 7,000 aircraft, more than that, commercial aircraft in China worth about $1 trillion, and Boeing wants a cut of that.
Right.
So Boeing is in the process of setting up what is called a sort of a finishing plant in near Shanghai to get into the market to show that they're committed, they're good neighbors, they're great guys, and to get the Chinese to like them. And what I point out is that when you go into China, particularly if you're going to set up operations, you are exposing yourself to all sorts of risks, particularly your key technology is just going to be under constant attack, both cyber attack, but also the human espionage that the Chinese excel at. And you've really set yourself up. You know, you've given away home court advantage, and for any decent intelligence service, and it's particularly in a very aggressive and really all-encompassing one, that I think the Chinese going to do very well against Boeing. And China, the one real big U.S. International industry that we still really have the lead on is commercial aviation. China wants into that industry, and in fact, when they want into any industry, they want the whole thing.
Right.
So their objective is to basically be the next Boeing and put Boeing out of business. And yet Boeing has gone into this expecting that they're going to make a ton of money, that they simply have to be there because the market's so big. And I'm not so sure that they have accurately assessed the risks. I have no doubt they've thought about it, but very often when there's a bonus and stock options involved, that Westerners will do what sea lions will do down at Sea Life Park in San Diego when they smell mackerel from their trainer. They'll do anything. They can rationalize this all the time. And I think Boeing is perhaps making a bit of a mistake here. By going into China and really getting themselves in the crosshairs of Chinese intelligence, it is worth noting that both the Airbus 320 and also not many people remember this any. Airbus 320 was actually produced in China. And also, nobody quite much remembers this, but McDonnell Douglas, this was a while back, actually set up a manufacturing plant for the MD-90 way back. Say it was a while back. And that eventually stopped. You know, they went out of – they ended that program. But it's worth noting that there are now – there's now two major programs in China by Chinese companies to build and sell regional jets that compete with the MD-90 class. That was McDonnell Douglas's old class. And Boeing has since abandoned that niche. So this shows what can be done by the Chinese, and also I think what's coming for Boeing. I think their thinking is, well, we're just putting in a 737 finishing operations, no big deal. We'll always be ahead of China. But I wouldn't be too sure about that. I think this is really, if not the beginning of the end, it's going to not end happily for Boeing.
I thought you were going to say it's the end of the beginning.
Yeah, it takes you a lot less time to read the article than it did to me for me to explain it.
Well, I find it very interesting because it seems like first of all, as a communist country, right, you know, to me, it runs itself on a bit of a thug gangster enterprise, and now China's economy. So is step one, let's make some kind of friends with the country. We'll open up diplomatic relations, and then we'll begin this opening our markets to their products. And our market's huge. So that is a huge step for manufacturers and producers in country X. Okay, now we establish, we get them hooked on the crack cocaine, which is the demand of the Chinese economy, and all boats in country X get lifted because they're exporting more. They're opening more factories. They're servicing Chinese need. Now, once we get our country, our new client, once we get them hooked on our demand, then we go to them and we can begin to say, it's essentially the way Clayton Lone Tree was compromised. Hey, we have pictures of you doing this. All we want is this. And you can't say no. Because if you say no, and this is what you see going on in this, in my opinion, in the Scarborough Shoals, do you want to push back on us, and do you want us to, you know, to slam the door shut on your economy, throwing people out of business, probably getting you booted out as the leader of that country? Is that what you want? Because we're more than willing to do it. It's not like we can't plug another nation into your slot in terms of manufacturing. It's easy to do. Oh, no, we don't want that to happen. So, you know, the United States has a Freedom of Navigation Act. China says they're going to further militarize the region, and the Philippines say, we're okay with that. We don't really have a beef with anybody here. And you watch it, and you're like, holy shit. So this seems to be the way China does business, in that the, you know, they, you know, you're going to be bludgeoned by their economy and your addiction for that economy, and there's not a whole lot you can do about it. Or there's not a whole lot that anybody's willing to do about it. Is that how this works? And also, ultimately, Boeing will be China's bitch, right? And to say nothing of the fact that Boeing has had most of their technology already stolen by the Chinese anyway. So is that the future for Western democracies?
Well, until we wake up, you know, that presumes that we just continue on a certain trend line and nothing happens to cause us to act differently. You know, I would say an optimistic, if there's a sort of an optimistic angle to this, it's within about the last two years-ish that you're finally starting to see more and more American companies operating in China to realize that the casino's rigged. And now they are more than ever supporting U.S. efforts to crack down on illegal Chinese trade activities or behavior, the Chinese cheating them, basically. However, I haven't seen that the administration has yet really pulled the trigger on this. But you are seeing a sort of a shift in U.S. Business thinking, and Boeing is kind of going against the tide, actually, by trying to get into China in this way. But what you have described is accurate. If you go back to when all this started in about 1981, which I remember very well, is the Chinese welcomed in foreign companies like this, and they required them to operate as joint ventures, and they required them to turn over all sorts of technology. And the idea was, as the Chinese said, oh, just so we can catch up, you know, we're trying to recover from, you know, this horrible situation we have. So this just has to continue just for a while. But just for a while, well, this just for a while continues to the present day. So that's been the racket, is you invite foreigners in. They each think they're going to sell one of something to every person in China. And you keep, convince them to hand, you require them to hand over technology, business right. know-how.
Right.
You steal a whole bunch of it as well. And that it's all with the allure of the Chinese market. So with us, though, we've kept this up, and in the process, we've allowed China to build up a very strong power. For all the shortcomings it has, it is now a pretty strong country, and it, which is puts it in a different position than it used to be. So it's now willing, more willing to throw its weight around and say, well, okay, well, if you're going to sort of cause trouble in the South China Sea, America, well, we're going to make it even harder for you in China. We're going to, we have some economic, we can retaliate against you economically. The dynamic's a little different with a country like the Philippines, which doesn't really have any possibilities of making anything in China, but rather those are countries that export. And say in the Philippines case, it's say bananas. And so China is very much able to sort of say, well, we don't need any bananas, or you're, as they have done, your bananas are poisoned, so we're not going to allow you to export them. That causes a country like the Philippines an awful lot of trouble, and that's part of the reason why they have sort of shifted over towards being pro-China as opposed to pro-American. The Australians as well have had this debate going on for a while now, because they have sold so much, particularly raw materials, to China. And there's been some questioning about the Australian ties with the United States, which is more important, the Americans for defense or the Chinese for economics. So the you see these different kinds of pressure being applied by the Chinese in different kinds of way, also of sort of hoodwinking foreigners who seem to be endlessly hoodwinkable.
Watching it, it's, you know, it's the same, again, it's extortion. I guess, you know, it's national extortion. And I guess the only thing that we can take solace in is at some point the Chinese people will have their own revolution. And China will evolve as a nation. And this whole idea of communism, which has been thrown off in most developing countries and will be thrown off, in my opinion, in both Russia and China at some point, because the march of freedom is led by intellectual exchange in a free-flowing world of ideas. And we pretty much have that now. People attempt to shut it off all the time, but it doesn't work. It doesn't work. It is the genesis of what you see in the Middle East. You know, what's going on in Saudi Arabia right now isn't because that guy's in a good mood, right? He knows that if the monarchy is going to be sustained in the kingdom of, in the royal house of the Saud, that, the Jordanian king knows it too. You better improve the people's lives. You better give them the freedom that they want. You better give them all of that, or else guess what? You're going to wind up in a bad video on YouTube someplace, you know, with your head getting popped off. And that's not good. So anyway, so that's the only solace I have, though, because I watch it and the whole thing that, you know, Putin's essentially head of a criminal nation, you know, and you can take it from his conduct around the world to their conduct in the Olympics. And it's just lying. And for whatever reason, you know, and when it seems like Russia's fate is inextricably linked to Europe on one side and Asia on the other, and the economic integration of Russia would only free the Russian economic engine, but he won't do that, and he resorts to this. And again, it goes back to if you read who is it, Dateline, what, the PBS show Dateline, I think it is, did a very interesting thing about Putin and what he saw happening to Gaddafi, what's happened to Saddam Hussein, and then the overtures that happened when the Ukrainian thing got going, and things that came out of the State Department under Hillary Clinton. And the theory is what he did to her was the payback for him seeing that she tried to incite some kind of rebellion against him earlier in the decade, that he would ultimately wind up like Muammar Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein. In neither case, though, did those end well. So interesting. Your thoughts on all that, Grant?
Putin did always, you know, one, some ways he's, one, have to admire him for his ability, not least to get sort of really like a bully taking Barack Obama's lunch money every day and stuffing his head in the toilet and flushing it. But he's what you described. He is a thug. I would note that he's also rather popular within Russia. That though, of course, any opposition doesn't really have the option, the opportunity to get traction, but he does have a degree of popularity. But he is exactly what you described. He is the antithesis of everything that America considers good and really proper in terms of international behavior. And but it's all about survival. And you look at him, and he's, I think, on a roll of sorts, this Syria business. You know, you used to have them with like one sort of leaky destroyer with a breaking at a broken down pier in Syria. Now you've got pretty much a Russian naval task force there permanently. You have Russian bases in Syria. They're back in the Mediterranean. That's just one example of how
right.
He's managed to play a terrible hand, sort of aided by, I think, U.S. administrations. So he's, he's on a roll at the moment, but this has a way of coming and going. One thing I'd note about China that I forgot to mention, and it's sort of, once again, it's, since it is almost 2 a.m., I'm feeling optimistic here in the in Japan. But it's this whole Chinese thing, this machine they've got going. It depends, say all the money they're spending to build this One Belt, One Road, all these projects around the world to buy off countries, to keep their own companies going, to buy foreign companies as well, that it depends on a constant input of money from outside. And that's the foreign direct investment that comes into China. And that's why they're so sensitive about this. And no matter how much they may hate it, they really do try to attract a foreign investment, because it has to have that constant input, sort of like putting gasoline into a generator. You know, the generator runs fine as long as it has gasoline, but once that runs out, it starts to sputter. And that is where there's a real vulnerability on the part of China. And if the West can ever recognize this and really just cut down the flow of sort of Western companies getting into China. And China may help us in that by making it so unattractive to do business there. But if you could, for example, find a company like Boeing that says, no, we simply cannot afford to be in this market. If, you know, China wants to buy things from us, that's one thing, but we're not going to go there and help them. If you could somehow cut that, the input, I think you could find China actually runs out of money. Because I don't think it has as much money as it claims to have. And what I would point to here is that for the last, 20, 25 years, every Chinese person who can has been trying to get their money out of China and ideally get a relative out with a green card. And that is suggesting some real doubts about the country's future. But in a very practical terms, it means that the Chinese government doesn't have all that much money. That's why they have put on recently a limit on the amount of money that people can charge overseas each year with a credit card. It's about $15,000. Additionally, a Chinese person can only export about $50,000 in currency. Now, in the U.S., our limits are zero. We can do whatever. We can take any amount out of the country anytime, take it anywhere we want.
Right.
So, but whenever a country puts on exchange controls like that, foreign exchange controls, that it means they've got some concerns. And this has not really been reported or picked up on, but I think that China may not have that much money. And if you can interrupt it somehow, then that will have an effect on their ability to build their military and to do all these other things they do around the world. But it's a vulnerability. I say I've not read anything about that. But to me, it's pretty apparent. And I would note they claim to have $4 trillion in foreign exchange reserves, which is the figure you always hear. I don't think $4 trillion is actually all that much money. So I just wanted to point that out as sort of that the game isn't over, and we have a pretty good hand to play if we could somehow interrupt the inflow or the input of money into the Chinese machine.
Interesting. Grant Newsham, my guest. You can find his work in AsiaTimes.com, and he writes on a weekly basis. Grant, how often do you appear there?
Well, it seems about every 9 or 10 days. Okay. I only write when I'm resentful of things. It's about that long for the resentment to accumulate, so I have an idea.
All right, another email. And, Mac, what does Grant expect the North Koreans will do during the Olympics? They have the entire world watching that peninsula. I don't think they're going to not attempt to communicate something during that period of time. I read about a big military parade that they intend to have. Grant's thoughts on all of this. What will they do?
Oh, yeah. Possibly the parade. I think I'd read something about that. But I don't see them doing anything provocative, such as, say, shooting off a missile or a nuclear test or sinking a South Korean ship or such like. That would be my guess, is that for about whatever the 2-3 weeks of the games, I think they'll be pretty quiet. That would be my prediction here. You know, it could be wrong, but I think that parade seems to be the only thing that I've heard of that is kind of warlike. But that's just my guess. And one recalls it's very different circumstances that the last Winter Olympics in Sochi, in Russia, that these things were pretty calm then. But boy, after that, Mr. Putin went to work. Once again, taking our president's lunch money and stuffing his head in the toilet. I'm not too worried about what's going to happen this month. But in March, it should get pretty interesting.
Anything that you want people to know relative to the current state in the Pacific Rim that I have not teed up for you? The Boeing thing to me I find interesting because it is just one more company going down that road. The technology is ever more sensitive. General Mattis and Chairman Dunford over the course of the last 2 weeks, I want to say, have been, you know, it's out there, and you see more and more people commenting on the technological advantage that we have enjoyed is now evaporated or very small. So it's interesting. So anything that I haven't been smart enough to ask you that you want to get off your chest?
No, not really. You did touch on something at the beginning when you noted that, and I think it is worth keeping in mind, is when you noted that the Chinese are now saying that, well, it's the Americans who have threatened us in the South China Sea who caused all the trouble, so we have no choice but to further our military control of the region. They basically said that. It's the Americans' fault for provoking us. And you will recall that just a couple of years ago that President Xi came to Washington. He promised that the islands in the South China Sea would not be militarized. He simply lied to the American president, not that that was a hard thing for him to do.
Right.
But it shows what kind of people these are. But we've by allowing this situation to develop, that now China does feel as if it's got the upper hand in the South China Sea. It is almost daring the United States to do something. And that is, I thought, a very worrisome development. There is a point at which it just gets too hard for us to do much down there. And this kind of everybody knows that even if America can sort of go through the region or do something, that it's really, you know, it's temporary. That's the Chinese who dominate. And we're getting close to being in that, I think, in that situation. And the Chinese, I think, psychologically are feeling like they have just about got to the point where they can lay down the law in the South China Sea. There's a little ways to go, but it's a thing to watch is what happens at Scarborough Shoals, I think, because I think the Chinese are, at some point not too distant future, are going to start to refill build an island down there too. So that's one thing I would point out as to that the Chinese are feeling like they've got the moral superiority down in the South China Sea, at least.
All right. First of all, thank you for staying up late. I appreciate that. And you have more and more fans. The people that I know that listen to the program, you are a favorite in terms of making them smart about things that are going to happen. And just then when they see other events happening, they draw parallels. And I can't thank you enough for coming on a regular basis and contributing, Grant. Thank you very much.
Well, I'd always appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity.
All right, sir. Sayonara.
Okay, sayonara. Yes, to me, okay, bye-bye.
All right, bye. Bye. Yeah, how about that? I boomed a little Japanese in there. Yeah, konnichiwa. All right. You know, my dumbass, hey, yeah, Dash 2, second, now he's a first lieutenant now. He's running through the backyard. He's probably 7 or 8 at the time. And he's chasing either a friend or his older brother. And I'm in the house and I hear him yell, I know Spanish. I'm like, what? And he's running through the backyard. And then he yells, Konnichiwa! I'm like, what a dumbass, man. That kid's got no future. That kid's got no future in life. No future in life. Yeah, konnichiwa. So, and you know where he learned konnichiwa? Back to the Future movies. When Marty McFly is going ahead and I think it's the third one where, you know, they're into the future and they've got the screen and George McFly's being yelled at by some guy from Tokyo. So anyway, all right, we're going to take a break. My thanks to Grant Newsham for coming on. Always makes us smart. And it is. It's criminal enterprises being run out of China and Russia, you know. And I don't care if you dress them up with all the flags and all the pageantry. They're still bullshit. And the world is a poorer place because we have democratic nations. Well, let me tell you, the United States has mismanaged the shit out of it. George Bush, Barack Obama, joke. And now you try to right the ship and you try to do the right things, and, you know, it's not easy. More of All Marine Radio coming up next. The Gunner. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military? For a first responder? For a hunter? For an outdoorsman? Or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner's looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the SOC community should be aware of.
The Global South Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.